You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Since video footage captured the killing of George Floyd, Wisconsin agencies have pledged to review their use of force policies and invested in body cameras. Corrine Hess reports families of those killed by police officers in Wisconsin are hoping the footage can lead to justice.
When Joel Acevedo died from injuries at the hands of an off-duty Milwaukee police officer last spring, his parents, Maribel and Jose, were told their son had been the aggressor. Months later, the Acevedos saw police body camera footage that they say showed them a different version of events. At a press conference in December, Maribel said the 40 hours of footage needed to be released publicly.
It's black and white evidence that there is no justification for what he did to my son. I don't care what narrative they have. It is not justifiable.
The judge in the case, William Pucan, is expected to rule on the releasing of the footage tomorrow. Joel Acevedo died on April 25th, 2020, 6 days after being in a chokehold for 11 minutes and 20 seconds. He was at a party at the home of former Milwaukee police officer Michael Mattioli when he reportedly got into a fight that led to the strangling. Mattioli has been charged with first-degree reckless homicide. His attorney says releasing the tape would interfere with his ability to receive a fair trial. Acevedo family attorney B. Ivory Lamar says the public has a right to know what happened.
You see the body camera footage, I think it paints a completely different picture, and I think that will provide the basis as to the public understanding why it's being fought so hard for it to not be made available.
In recent weeks, there have been several high-profile killings by police officers where video footage was quickly released to the public. First, former Brooklyn Center, Minnesota police officer Kim Potter was charged with second-degree manslaughter after fatally shooting Dante Wright during a traffic stop. Many believe the charges came quickly because footage from Potter's body-worn camera was released right away. Days later in Chicago, police released footage revealing 13-year-old Adam Toledo's empty hands were raised above his shoulders when he was fatally shot by an officer the month before. A very different scenario than what police originally reported. A Wisconsin Department of Justice survey released earlier this year found three-quarters of the departments that responded used body cameras. Of those, about 88% say they've been using the devices for at least a year. Cynthia Lum is a criminology professor at George Mason University. She says body cameras are only as good as the policies that dictate how they're used.
People and the police can feel and have perceptions one way or about one thing, but I think the more important thing is whether or not body-worn cameras actually deliver on the outcomes that we expect from them.
In the Milwaukee suburb of Wauwatosa, police officers have been wearing body cameras since February. Sergeant Abby Pavlik says the cameras are always on, and when an officer is about to have an interaction, they activate the camera. Videos are saved for at least 3 months. Pavlik says Wauwatosa would release footage on a case-by-case basis.
Anytime we release footage or any type of kind of an open records, we base it on the public's need to know versus we weigh that balance of what needs to be seen to preservation of, you know, evidence or somebody's personal information.
Jay Anderson Sr. wishes Wauwatosa officers were wearing body cameras in 2016 when former officer Joseph Menza fatally shot his son. Menza approached Jay Anderson Jr. while he was sleeping in his car. Family members say he was inebriated, but Menza says Anderson was reaching for a gun when he shot him. Menza was never charged in the killing, but Jay Anderson Sr. thinks his story may not have held up if there was video of the encounter.
A body cam is what we need on every police force in the United States.
As the Acevedo family awaits the murder trial of former Milwaukee police officer Michael Mattioli, they hope the release of the body cam footage will provide clarity in the moments that led to their son's death. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, police liability insurance, could it be part of the solution to issues of police accountability? Each year, millions of taxpayer dollars are spent in covering the costs of lawsuits over police misconduct and brutality. Like physicians and lawyers, officers are subject to civil liability for their actions on the job. But unlike other professionals, police aren't required to carry individual professional liability insurance. Are you in law enforcement? What's your take on liability insurance in your line of work? It's 800-642-1234. Deborah Ramirez is a law professor at Northeastern University. She works on police accountability with academia, law enforcement, politicians, and community leaders. Deborah, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Katie. It is a pleasure to be here.
Well, Deborah, you advocate for police officer liability insurance. Explain how it would work.
Well, I think before I explain how it works, your listeners probably need to understand what the state of police accountability is right now. Because professional liability insurance is trying to solve a particular problem. And the problem, as you know from the radio clip that we just heard about a young man being killed in Milwaukee, is that police brutality right now in the United States remains unchecked because the police unions, through collective bargaining, have created a system that makes it nearly impossible for police chiefs to discipline or fire police officers for misconduct. So people say to me, Debbie, why does this occur over and over again? Why do we continue to see these tapes? And I say because right now in the United States, we don't have any way to get bad cops off the streets. We don't have any mechanism to weed out the bad officers so that the good ones can thrive. And your listeners, I'm sure, will understand this because they have been watching TV and radio. We know that the only way that we are dealing with police brutality in this country now is to react. Once an officer engages in brutal policing, we try to react. Indict them in the criminal justice system if we can, hold them liable with damages. So in the last trial with Derek Chauvin, we indict him for murder, and the Floyd family gets $27 million in damages. But the criminal justice system is ill-equipped to provide the kind of accountability we need, and the Floyd family gets $27 million, but the city of Minneapolis is going to pay 100% of that. And so, Derek Chauvin will pay not one penny.
Yeah. So using, you know, Chauvin as an example, how would liability insurance have played a role in this?
Well, that's a good question, because we looked into Derek Chauvin's background. He had been on the force for 19 years. Mm-hmm. He had 18 complaints. Two of them were sustained. He'd been involved in multiple shootings. Now, 18 complaints is a high number compared to the other officers. His complaint numbers alone should have triggered some sort of review. Most officers in doing his kind of work get one or two complaints in 7 years. And there was a very interesting sustained complaint. You were talking about body cameras and car cameras. In this sustained complaint, a woman was going 10 miles over the speed limit. He stopped her, pulled her out of her car, frisked her, and interestingly, his car video and audio were off. The department sustained this and issued a warning letter. But all of this should have triggered concerns by an auditor long before Chauvin met George Floyd. So had there been a professional liability insurance system in place, his record would have triggered high premiums. His continued record of recklessness would have made those premiums soar. And he would have been priced out of policing before he ever met George Floyd.
So how would you force insurance companies to take an active role in regulating, in moderating police behavior and not look at it as another market opportunity, another way to grow the insurance industry and make it more lucrative?
Well, it may be a lucrative product for the insurance company, but it's 75% cheaper than what we're doing now. Hmm. In Minneapolis alone, okay, you have a $27 million settlement just from the Chauvin case, and 3 years ago, a $20 million settlement from the Daymond case. What insurance is going to do is save taxpayers 75% of what they're paying out because the officers who engaged in police brutality are priced out before those settlements and judgments come in. So the way it would work is that either the state or the municipality would require police officers to carry professional liability insurance, just the same way that doctors do, lawyers, and all officers have to carry it in order to police. And just as when doctors engage in reckless medical practices, operate on the wrong leg or arm, and when they do that, their premiums go up. And if they continue to do it, their premiums soar and they're priced out of medicine. In the same way, when an officer begins for the very first time to engage in reckless or dangerous policing acts, illegal searches, seizures, assaults, excessive use of force, the officer's premiums rise. And if they continue in this behavior, their premiums skyrocket and they should be priced out of policing. Now, under this system, the officers and their insurance companies pay the costs of police misconduct. And those with dangerous histories, tendencies or indicators are priced out of policing by premiums that reflect the actual risk of their dangerous behaviors. And the beauty of this system is that it is trying to get ahead of the problem by preventing, detecting, and deterring the kinds of terrible police brutality that we see on tape.
We have Northeastern University law professor Deborah Ramirez explaining what mandating police liability insurance would do to the profession. What's your take? Should we treat police officers like doctors about accountability for their mistakes? How do you feel about cities paying out settlements brought against officers who significantly harm or kill someone? Still time, your thoughts. Liability insurance for police, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Northeastern University law professor Deborah Ramirez is explaining the idea of liability insurance for police and having insurance companies manage risk and be active regulators in police behavior. And Deborah's here for 10 more minutes. Tom is joining us from Burlington. Hi, Tom. You're on the Ideas Network.
I would like to ask, Bob Kroll was the head of the Police Federation up until 21. I think he is now retired or gone. And the question is, do we need some kind of a federal program? He had been in public, had been a racist and had encouraged this bad behavior with people. And how can we, do we need a federal law or something to get control of this situation?
A federal oversight program for policing, Deborah?
Policing is local, and I'm not sure that we need a federal system, but Tom is correct that the unions are controlling policing right now. If you were to talk to any of the police chiefs, especially the big city police chiefs, they would tell you this. They can't hire the officers that they would like to hire to be guardians of the community. They can't promote those who are engaged in problem solving and excellent community policing. They can't discipline those who are using excessive use of force, and they can't fire them. All of the managerial tools of police chiefs have been, through the collective bargaining process, bargained away. And so what Tom is saying, he's really right to look at what is wrong with police unions and how much power do they have. The professional liability insurance system is a way to check that balance and to do something about it. Now, what we are saying needs to happen has to happen at the local level. So first, your listeners could contact their legislators and ask the state legislators to put in a bill that requires all of their police officers to carry professional liability insurance. Second, the legislators could narrow the scope of collective bargaining. They could say to the unions, as a matter of public safety, you may no longer bargain and force the municipalities to pay 100% of the cost of police misconduct. You may no longer bargain about disciplinary procedures for police officers. That should be done by the police chief. And you may no longer bargain about how and when an officer can be fired. The union should be concerned about health issues, health insurance, working conditions, but they should not be in charge of hiring, firing, and disciplining police officers. And right now they are. At a municipal level, your listeners could ask their municipal leaders to say to the police, as part of the collective bargaining process, we have heard from our taxpayers and they no longer want to pay 100% of the cost of your misconduct. You, the police officer, are going to be liable for the first, I don't know, $10,000, $20,000, $30,000. This has been done in Colorado.
And I wanted to bring up Colorado. What have been the takeaways there as they legislate on this issue?
Well, they've passed legislation saying we are not going to pay 100% of the cost of police misconduct anymore. So the first $25,000 has to be paid by the officer personally, which is where the judgment or settlement order goes. And the result of that is that the unions in Colorado came to us and to Primus Insurance, the insurance company we're working for, to say, we now want to offer professional liability insurance to our union members. Let's work together to create a product so that they won't lose their homes or resources if there's a judgment or settlement against them. And so in Colorado, it's coming from the bottom up as opposed to the top down. And the unions are actually working with us to create a professional liability insurance product for their officers.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Northeastern University law professor Deborah Ramirez. We're discussing liability insurance for law enforcement and how it might impact police brutality. With your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Joseph is joining us from Harrison. Joseph, I understand you're a former police officer.
Correct. And I agree with the I'm also a police behavioral scientist for 40 years, and I agree wholeheartedly with your guest. I would take it even further. I think we need to evaporate the police unions. I've worked for unions in the private sector, and they tend to protect the low-hanging fruit, the bad apples, and all the good top-notch police officers are being demoralized. They're leaving in droves, and I think the union needs to be evaporated because that will solve the problem. And I'll tell you right now, without unions, we will have higher quality police officers who stay, and the good cops will be reinforced, and the I call them the bad apples will be gone.
Debbie, do you see what Joseph is saying there? That this is mainly about just eliminating the union itself.
Well, I agree with Joseph, but I don't think it's politically possible. And I'm not anti-union. If the unions would act like other unions, police unions don't even call themselves unions. They call themselves associations because they're management. They're in control. I think the unions should advocate again for safe working conditions, overtime policy. I think they should advocate for health and dental insurance, and the things that unions normally do to improve the job. The problem with police unions is that we gave them too much power. They were allowed in the political process, like other unions, obviously, to contribute money, but they also branded. So politicians needed the police unions to brand them as tough on crime, and they wanted a blue wall behind them. That gave the police unions way, way too much power. And this is the situation we're in.
Well, what about the argument that police are public servants? We shouldn't have private companies, private insurance companies mixing with public service.
I understand that argument, and they are public servants, but all public servants have checks and balances on them. And usually the public servants are responsible to a managerial apparatus. And we have basically told the chiefs, you can't hire, you can't fire, you can't discipline, you can't terminate. That means no one's in charge except the unions. And insurance companies are not going to be dictating day to day what happens in policing. A similar example of this is Moody's, which is a private company that creates risk assessment scorecards for municipalities that borrow money. Okay, Moody's does not tell the municipality what to do or interfere with day-to-day operations. They're private, but it rates them in terms of credit risk. Similarly, insurance companies here are creating risk assessment scorecards for police officers. It doesn't interfere with the day-to-day decision-making. It just assesses risk and prices it out. And I want to go back to what Joseph said, because many police officers have called me after I've given these presentations. And they say, you know what? You're right. When we saw that tape of Chauvin, we were horrified. We were demoralized. We were ashamed. That is not who we are. And they said, what I like about your system is that you actually are trying to identify the officers who are having problems, and they're easy to identify. They're getting restraining orders, et cetera, and you're trying to price them out or give them treatment.
Deborah, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Deborah Ramirez, professor at Northeastern University School of Law, works on police reform and racial profiling issues. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.